CliffCentral.com.
It is a Thursday, and that means it's time for the Burning Platform, which is brought to you every Thursday morning by Nando's. We talk about all the stories that are going on in South Africa and the world that may be of interest to you, things that affect you, things that you may be curious about, and we try to find people who have interesting takes on these. This morning we didn't have to try, we just had to go, who do we want to hear from again? And in fact, I got lots of messages from people who said they thoroughly enjoyed his former triumphant appearances on the Burning Platform. So I'm talking about Jean-Jacques Cornish, JJ Cornish, who joins us again. JJ, nice to see you. You can unmute your microphone at will, and the same goes for you, Canton. Canton Pillay, our returning champion as well. Good to see you both. I know it's freezing cold in the winter, so I appreciate all the more the fact that you dragged yourselves out of bed to share your thoughts and opinions with us this morning. There's so little to talk about, though. We may only be busy for 5 minutes, of course. There's no news at all. Nothing's happening. This is 2020 is a boring year. It's just like all the others. I don't know why we even bother, right?
Well, bacon sandwiches are right here, so that's what matters.
Oh, you've made yourself bacon sandwiches, have you?
Yeah, it's my daily routine now. Yeah,
oh, so, very good.
Which is why I didn't have time for the test call with Sia.
JJ, how are you?
I'm well. I was a vegetarian now for 50 years, so I've got a little boiled suet here in front of me. And a couple of yams.
Yams.
I'm a real vegetarian foodie, man.
So, all right, gentlemen, there's something that came up just a moment ago. We were talking to Sean Sanders from Revix about mobile money in Zimbabwe and what a disaster that is. So, JJ, you are, without any dispute, I'm sure, the foremost expert on keeping an eye on the rest of this continent that we live on. It's an enormous continent. There's a lot to keep an eye on. But surely Zimbabwe must be on top of everyone's agenda when it comes to failed states and the stupid things they do. They've done extra stupid things this week. Didn't they just shut down the stock exchange?
And this was the military that did this. You know, I've had more calls from MPs and others saying, has there been a coup in Zimbabwe? More calls from them, people concerned about that, than I've had.
Yes, there was a coup in Zimbabwe in 1980.
Exactly. And, I mean, there was a coup. There was a coup when I lived there, or just before I lived there, with Ian Smith.
Yes, but now precisely. Everybody and seems now, to be now thinking, Emmerson Mnangagwa is just the latest leader of the coup.
Well, they're just feeling that there's a huge amount of frustration about his dithering. And it seems that it's the military that went in and stopped the money. Mechanical money market, which is the way people are selling stuff and moving stuff around, and close the stock exchange. So, I mean, that, you know, how much more of a coup do you need than that? Although when you look at the stock exchange and the way it works, it's absolute anarchy and has been for years. So Zimbabwe, in an absolutely parlous state, is now even worse off. And I don't know just how any business is transacted. How, for example, well, happily it's not the tobacco season, but that's the thing that they've got to sell. But, you know, I just don't know how any business in that country, benighted country, is transacted.
Well, let's just put business aside for a second, because actually for most Zimbabweans, 92% unemployment, most of them don't actually have a means to even feed themselves by buying things. They have to either subsistence live by growing a few things in their back garden and passing chickens to each other over a fence. And it's just the most awful backsliding in terms of a country that really could have everything going for it if it just had a better government. And surely on the failed states index, which they publish every year, Zimbabwe just keeps sliding further and further down.
It must be at the bottom of it, you know, but the cliche, the old journalistic cliche, not that I've ever touched one of those in my life, was that Zimbabwe was the bread basket and now has become the basket case.
Yeah.
You know, when they hoofed me out, I was covering the election and they didn't like that. And they caught me and kicked me out. I stayed at a place just over the border, and through the night, the proprietor came down the next morning and said, come and look here, and counted the number of people who had come across the river through his fence and across his property to get into South Africa. And there was something like 1,700 that night. So, I mean, that's exactly those Zimbabweans who cannot feed their families. That's what they're doing. And right now, of course, the Zambezi River is fairly low. And they're able to, and they're coming over in droves. And
you mean the Limpopo?
There's not much we can do about it. The Limpopo, yeah. Excuse me. Yeah.
If it was the Zambezi, they'd be going in the wrong direction.
Well, I think there's any direction is better for the Zimbabweans, probably even Angola and Namibia, yeah?
Canton, I do want to move on to something else with JJ, but is there anything you'd like to add on Zim?
Fascinating thing about Zim, of course, is that it's... it really would be the perfect test case for us to be considering a mass rollout of cryptocurrency, because effectively...
Yeah, that's exactly what Sean Sanders was saying just a minute ago, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this actually becomes interesting at a number of other levels, because it ties in with another story that's actually important this week. Now, I don't know if you guys are familiar with a social media platform called Gab, G-A-B.
No.
Okay, well, Gab was launched a few years ago, and it's been positing itself as an alternative to Twitter, basically. And the interesting thing about Gab is that it has no restrictions whatsoever in terms of what may be said on the platform.
Okay.
Yeah, so I've had an account on Gab for a few years. I never really post anything there, but I do hop over to see what it's the like of InfoWars and... the anti-vaxxers and, there's a lot of the lunatic fringe out there, but then there's also some, fiercely right-wing people and all of that kind of stuff. But Gab was deplatformed by both Apple and by the Google Play Store. So in other words, you can't get an app that, that serves Gab. More importantly, though, last week, Visa, as in the payment system, cut off Gab from receiving any funding by credit card on the basis that this was tantamount to hate speech. And you have to understand now that I'm conflicted by this because, clearly I support the right of private companies to run their businesses as they see fit, and Visa is a private company.
Yeah.
On the other hand, Visa is so massive that it does have a stranglehold in Visa and MasterCard combined, that is. They have a stranglehold in terms of how money moves. And all of these problems fundamentally come back to the same situation that you have in Zimbabwe. It's the inability of money to move freely and for government to then try and steal that money by printing money effectively that causes all these problems. And fundamentally, at the heart of how you fix all of these things and create a freer world is by having cryptocurrencies. So let me just leave that thought in terms of Zimbabwe.
Yeah, I'm so pleased you brought that up, because it's something that came up on my TV show last night about cancel culture and the fact that now, basically free corporations and free enterprises that are run by shareholders or by customers in some cases, these people are being strong-armed into taking up political positions, which they have no business in doing. I don't really care whether Google, Apple, or the people who make the tea bags in my tea this morning are woke. It does not interest me in the least. In fact, if you look at many of these companies that profess to be so woke, many of them employ very cheap, if not slave labor, in countries like Indonesia and Malaysia and such places. To their great chagrin, they are actually probably the masters, in inverted commas, of far more slaves now than their ancestors may have been when they started those companies, or companies of their like, in years where slavery was a thing.
But that was always the premise of globalization to start off with, for the markets to be able to move production to where labor was cheapest.
Well,
and in the case of China, devoid of human rights.
But then let's not pretend that we're good people at the same time, because clearly we're not.
Hypocrisy is a cornerstone of world culture. Come on.
It drives me crazy. So I do want to move to something else quickly. We can always get back to this in a minute. But Botswana and South Africa have got a bit of a diplomatic row going on at the moment, and it involves no less than the president's sister-in-law. This is so embarrassing, JJ. I reflected very briefly on it in the headlines earlier this morning. Bridget Motsepe Radebe gave this ridiculous interview, I think, to ENCA, in which she really did not acquit herself very admirably. It reminded us, when Sia and I were talking about it, of Prince Andrew talking about Jeffrey Epstein in that revolting interview that he did not so long ago with the BBC. What is actually going on? You have contacts in Botswana. They've apparently appointed AfriForum to help them deal with this Brigitte Motsepe Radebe situation. What's really going on?
The fact is, the Botswana government comes across as, or presents itself as, the bastion of democracy on the continent. It has the country, it's the country with the second largest per capita income behind Gabon. And it presents itself as this bastion of democracy and a paragon of good governance, et cetera, et cetera. But actually, the Botswana government is quite a spiteful bunch. I brokered the sale of a newspaper there, and the newspaper had displeased them. They simply stopped advertising in it and brought it to its knees. This is the sort of thing the Botswana government does. It moves in. I mean, you know, the legacy with South Africa is we owe them a great deal because they, of course, hosted the liberation movements during the apartheid era at great risk to themselves and great cost to themselves, physical and financial. And so that history is something that play is in play all the time. And of course, the Tswanas like to say that, you know, we could tell South Africa how to do things a lot better. For example, they haven't allowed in South Africa the wealth to trickle down. This is the ANC government, whereas we in Botswana are doing it. Of course, the reality is they're reliant, or completely reliant, on the diamond industry, and the rest is ancillary. So there is this kind of rivalry. And Botswana being a small, relatively small, one, an absolutely small neighbor, feels the brunt of a big South African neighbor dominating the region, and they don't like this. So they're very, very sensitive to what happens in South Africa. They believe, for example, when you listen to Botswana radio, that we still have effectively white control in this country, and that the ANC has not done the job it should have done, that they had hoped for when they harboured the ANC during the liberation period. So there is that history in play all the time. They have taken a strong line on Zimbabwe, and told Robert Mugabe he had to go. And now they're very reticent about what is happening with Emmerson Mnangagwa, and they would like South Africa again to speak out more vociferously on what's happening in Zimbabwe. So essentially, this is a country that would like to play more of a leadership role, and of course, having the SADC secretariat there is something that pleases them. Mm-hmm. But it's essentially a big brother thing, and this is something that is multiplied across the region. Countries that look to South Africa with some resentment to the leadership role it plays and believe that it should sometimes wind its neck in rather than say and do things. I always say, if you want to know what the region thinks about South Africa, ask a Zambian. They're probably the most vociferous. But it's that.
Sorry, I just want to quickly find out. The whole situation with Brigitte Motsepe Radebe, what is that all about? Is that just being used as a device?
Let me just climb in on that case, because everything that Jean-Jacques says in terms of the broad picture is absolutely correct. But the specifics that we have here right now is that there are insinuations from the current Botswana regime, because remember that the Khama government was displaced, and the current regime believes that there was an attempt on the part of Brigitte Motsepe Radebe to fund a toppling of the current government. And they have actually called for criminal investigations to be brought into the matter. And they approached DIRCO with a view to getting DIRCO to actually facilitate this. Because the way in which it's meant to work is that you make the overture via your diplomatic channels, which then takes it through to the criminal channels in your country and then takes it further from there. The problem, of course, is that DIRCO has refused to actually action this, which is what finally triggered them briefing AfriForum. Because remember that private prosecutions can only be brought on behalf of aggrieved individuals.
Yes.
And not by a third party. So they've briefed AfriForum to try and effectively launch a private prosecution initiative. And I don't want to say private prosecution in the current sense, because, you know, that would suggest that there's implied criminality on the part of Motsepe Khadebe. But certainly to act on their behalf to ensure that appropriate investigations are conducted to see whether this was in fact the case. Did one of the richest and most influential people in our country try to influence a change of government in our neighbor to the north? And that is the heart of what this issue is all about.
And it does kind of remind us that, I mean, you mentioned Ian Khama just now. His father, Sir Seretse Khama, was the first, you know, president of a free Botswana, essentially, when it was decolonialized. But there's a dynasty in Botswana. And we here in South Africa, we're sitting with our own interconnected web of relatives. You know, you've got Jeff, who's married to Bridget. Bridget is Tsepo's sister. Tsepo is Cyril's wife. And then their brother-in-law, Cyril and Jeff's brother-in-law, is Patrice, who's one of the richest men in Africa, if not the world. And it's all a very tangled web, but it shows you just how, you know, dynastic politics is not just something for Europe and its aristocracies.
Absolutely. Very much so. Sorry, Jean-Jacques, go for it.
Well, you know, the thing about it, I wouldn't say it was an overthrow. Effectively, Mokgweetsi was the man fingered by Ian Khama to take over, and which he did. But when he did, he rode roughshod over everything that Ian Khama had done, including, or most importantly, the wildlife conservation. Ian Khama was crazy about that. He was also very authoritarian. In his family, they'd had problems with drink, and so he was very ascetic. He was the sort of guy that used to walk in to public service offices and scold the civil servants sitting at their desks, ask them what they were doing.
Is this
something
Khama,
much appreciated.
Khama or Mokgweetsi?
No, this is Khama.
Okay.
Now Mokgweetsi, of course, has become is more populist, and there's no doubt that within the higher echelons of the South African government, they were more comfortable with Ian Khama, even though he was outspoken. And so, you know, I don't think it was unnatural for them to campaign for Ian Khama. But I think what Bridget did was go a step too far. And so to suggest overthrow, yeah. I think is hyperbole. But nonetheless, Mokgweetsi is very sensitive about his position. And that is why he has taken a rather aggressive stance against Bridget.
Look, further to that, I must add that the other thing that the current regime has done is that they've been clamping down on foreign ownership of businesses within the country. And Mokgweetsi has now said that there has to be a more than 50% ownership by the people of Botswana in all of those businesses, which, you know, again, triggers some interesting side effects, because there's been a corresponding push in terms of foreign direct investment that's been going on during the Khama era, very successfully, I might add, which ties in with what Jean-Jacques was saying about the fact that, you know, certainly in sub-Saharan Africa, Botswana is sitting with the highest per capita income. Yes, and the only two countries that are ahead are Seychelles and Mauritius, which are, you know, floating out there somewhere, even though Gabon is very much flirting with an intersection right now.
All right.
But fundamentally, it is a failure of governance on the part of our government, because at the point at which you have something that gets raised at an international level with the Department of Foreign Affairs, or International Relations, as they prefer to call themselves these days, that needs to be actioned at the highest level and not just simply sat on. And that is the true embarrassment, because I'm certainly not presuming any guilt on the part of Motsepe Khadebe in this case. But if it's not investigated, if there isn't a spotlight shone upon it, then people are going to assume that there's some truth to it.
Well, that's exactly what's happening. And it is, you mentioned that they're spiteful. The Botswana government are sometimes spiteful at JJ. And I mean, they couldn't do a more spiteful thing than to go and hire AfriForum's Harry Nell to do this, because they know that in South African politics, you couldn't get more far apart than, you know, the people on the left and AfriForum.
Well, absolutely. The thing is, of course, Botswana was an area, I mean, the reason why I got involved there was somebody trying to hire me to handle PR for investment there. But it was, again, white investment in the country. When I checked on it with sources and so on, I remember particularly intelligence sources said, yes, you could do it. And yeah, they'll pay you telephone number salaries, but your credibility as a journalist would be gone forever. What was happening was people were, they had factories. Remember, they were trying to make Hyundai motor cars and that sort of thing there. So the fact that they are getting majority shareholding for Tswanas in Botswana is affecting South African business. And again, that would impact on the wealthier South Africans who are going to lose money as a result of it.
Yeah, does Patrice have any interests there in Botswana? I mean, he's in mining, but they're mostly in metals. Botswana's more in diamonds. Does he have interests?
And I would be very surprised if he didn't, but I couldn't list the interest. But I'd be very surprised. Patrice has a net that is widened over all of Southern Africa. Right. I've no doubt about that.
Okay, well, we've tried to unpack that as much as I think we can.
Well, by the way, this is probably a good entry point for me to just touch briefly on something else involving AfriForum.
Yes.
They won a significant victory in the appellate division this week.
Oh, yes?
Yes. Well, I mean, essentially, what happened was UNISA had taken a decision that it was going to stop instruction in Afrikaans. Mm-hmm. And AfriForum had taken them to the High Court, and the High Court ruled in favor of UNISA. And so they took it to the appellate division, and a full bench of the appellate division has ruled in their favor. They said that, actually removing Afrikaans as a medium of instruction is unconstitutional. Hmm. And UNISA is instructed to reverse that and publish notices to that effect and to once again start injecting funds in that direction, which is I completely agree with this because, again, the point that we've made in this space in the past is that it should not be about trying to cut back on Afrikaans, but about trying to actually boost the other languages as well.
Right. Yeah.
And really what should be happening is that UNISA should be offering instruction in all of our 11 official languages.
Again,
and that should be an investment the country should be making.
This is ideologically what separates some people from others in this country, is that some people see the cake as only being so big and we have to keep on slicing it into infinitely smaller pieces so that everyone gets their fair share, in inverted commas. Or you believe in the cake being expanded. And clearly there are those two types of mindset in South Africa when it comes to language.
And what I thought was particularly significant was that the president of the appellate division, Judge Meyer, delivered the judgment in both English and isiZulu, which, I don't recall seeing that in appellate division judgments before, but well done, guys. You know, really, this is, I think this is significant. And I've no doubt that the Department of Education is going to try to challenge it. But for God's sake, can we just start boosting the other languages instead of trying to tear down what we built up in the past?
No doubt this is going to go to the Constitutional Court, huh?
I'm sure that, you know, Canton's point is valid, that they'll as long as it's state resources, you don't mind spending that money, you know?
Well, speaking on behalf of the lawyers who must be rubbing their hands with glee, you know, they must be making a fortune.
Oh, absolutely. They're the only people who really win in a situation
indeed.
Like this. All the rest of us have to just deal with constant division in society as a result of it. Okay, can I ask you both to just comment? And since we've got you on, JJ, it's always great to hear your insights about the rest of the continent. What is happening in my favorite country of Somalia, which we know has been an anarchy for the longest time now? Surprisingly, somehow it has not completely destroyed itself and fallen to the core of the earth. But when you talk about Zimbabwe being at the bottom of the failed states index, Somalia occupied that position for a significant amount of time. Have we seen any improvement there? Is there anything worth noting in Somalia at the moment?
Well, I was hoping to tell you that they've opened or reopened their football stadium, national stadium. This was the home of the peacekeeping forces until they left last year. And so, you know, it was effectively a military barracks. They've spent a lot of money, and there were wonderful pictures of this beautifully renewed football stadium with a lovely pitch, and they had a football game there, I'm sure, for social distancing. I don't like to use the phrase social distancing. For physical distancing, that must have broken the thing. They've got very small numbers in terms of COVID-19. But whilst the team, whilst the people were flocking in, the president had just left, having made a little speech reopening the stadium. Three mortar shells were sent in. And we don't know about the casualties exactly, but of course the football fans then were sent ducking for cover. Every time Somalia tries to sort itself out, to restore to us stability, they have these kind of setbacks. You know, Al-Shabaab has been driven out of the cities and towns of Somalia, but it operates from the countryside and is able then to move into the cities and towns whenever it feels like it for indiscriminate acts of terror. Now, we do have the U.S. Africa Command, that is the U.S. military wing looking at Africa, saying that Somalia cannot contain Al-Shabaab, and will not be able to bring them to book. And so there's the Turks are getting involved there, trying to get more and more involved in helping Somalia. Various countries are, but the fact is they haven't been able to bring Al-Shabaab to book. And every single time they open a hotel or a restaurant, they get attacked. And, you know, you take your life in your hands going to eat at a restaurant in Somalia, or stay at a good hotel, or go anywhere where the diplomats go.
The same is true, right?
United States opened its embassy there again. And so, you know, every step forward they take three steps backwards in terms of facing terror.
George, just a question, though. Who is funding Al-Shabaab? Because this is not an inexpensive business to be having this war of attrition, really.
Well, Al-Shabaab, of course, is funded by the same terror groups that fund Al-Qaeda and other Islamist fundamentalist terror groups.
Yes, so, but
there's all sorts of funding coming in, shady funding from the Gulf, particularly. It's a wealthy country in essence, Somalia, and should. There's a coin to be made in getting control there more and more.
Are they still suffering from such a problem with piracy?
Well, they are. They've had, well, the piracy's actually moved to the Gulf of the other side of Africa, around Nigeria. That's where they had an attack just the other day. But, you know, interestingly, Somaliland,
yes,
which was, of course, the country, you know, Somalia was Italian, Somaliland was British protected colony.
Right.
And then during the reign of the Somali government, they bombed Somaliland so that one stone didn't stand on another in Hargeisa, the capital.
Mm-hmm.
Somaliland then withdrew and became an independent country, not recognized, but a bit of a bastion of democracy. Now, there were talks between the Somali and Somalilanders. There have been two sets of talks, but one just recently, 2 weeks ago, that was very encouraging. And suddenly we see this bastion of democracy that I mentioned, Somaliland, actually cracking down on media. They've closed the television station, and we have the Committee to Protect Journalists today calling for them to reopen that. So democracy taking a step backwards in Somaliland, which, of course, abuts Djibouti. And then, of course, you know, when you look at the Horn of Africa, at the top of that seven of the Horn is where Somaliland is. So the news out of the whole of greater Somalia, is not good at the moment, I'm afraid, Gareth.
Well, I didn't really have high expectations, let's be perfectly honest. You did say, though, that Somalia has a president. That's curious. Have they had elections? Who is this president? Do we know much about him?
Well, he's Mohamed. They've had elections.
So good you had to name him twice.
But they've now put it off. the elections. They were going to hold elections quite shortly. They put them off until next year. But he was brought in. He was in exile in Britain for a long, long time and came in. And he sounded very good, you know, his judgment is pure and he wants things to happen. But again, it's one of those situations where every time they seem to be making progress, the terrorists are able to come in and put the kibosh on it.
Shame. I've got to say though, guys, that still some of the most drop dead gorgeous women in the world come from that neck of the woods.
Well, do you remember Iman? She was married to the guy from Duran
David.
Duran.
She was married
To Bowie. David Bowie. To David Bowie. Yes.
That's quite right. Bowie. Iman was from. Yeah, she was from there. But there was another one. Hang on, was it Yasmin Le Bon who was married to Simon Le Bon too? Anyway, either of those women, yes, absolutely. Good point, well put. Nice bit of misogyny to throw into the burning platform this morning.
Got nothing to do with misogyny. It's got everything to do with my personal views in terms of what constitutes beauty.
Do you really think I'm accusing you of misogyny? Don't be ridiculous. Right, let's move on to some other things. So guys, first of all, COVID-19 seems to be dropping off the radar in a few places. But it's still very much among us, and it's very much a reason for us to interact with government on an almost weekly basis. Can we just talk quickly about how that's affecting, first of all, South Africa, and whether there have been any changes, because level 3 seems to go on forever and a day. There is no horizon on which we can see an end to level 3. And do you think that there are potentially some areas we could start freeing up that are not yet completely open? We talked about tobacco before. We've spoken about the gyms.
Couple of points. The first thing is, I don't know what your guys' experience has been, but certainly the number of if you had asked me 2 months ago, do I personally know anyone who has been infected with COVID-19? The answer was no.
Yeah.
If you ask me now, in my immediate circle, there are a number of people that I know. There are a number of deaths in my immediate circle as well. You know, just was comparing notes yesterday with a friend of mine who said that there, just in terms of West Park, the Jewish cemetery, there's about 6 funerals per day currently relating to COVID-19 deaths.
Wow.
So the uptick in terms of the fatalities from the infection rates have been growing quite substantially. How this translates in terms of the lockdown? Well, you know, again, going back to the discussion that we've had in the past, my view has always been that what you need to be doing is isolating all of the vulnerable people,
yes,
but allowing the economy to tick over as best as it possibly can. I don't think right now that I'm hearing anything from Ramaphosa's neck of the woods that would indicate that the president is thinking of anything substantial. I think they're winging it, and I really don't know what direction it's going to go from here. We've had, you know, restaurants opening up without alcohol. I think that that's a good thing to do as a starting point. I certainly don't think it's going to save most of those restaurants. But I think it's a slow process that's unfolding. But the deaths are real.
You know, restaurants without alcohol, I don't know, Gareth. That's like a one-legged man at an ass-kicking party. You know, it's not much use to anybody. The point is, winging it, Canton, is being very kind. These people don't know. And my favorite expression, they simply don't know. You know, my wife opened a school in January, and it went from strength to strength, rocketed upwards, everything looking fantastic, and suddenly COVID came and brought it to its knees. She was there all week preparing to reopen on the 6th, as the government said she could. And yesterday we hear, no, she can't. The fact is, they simply don't know.
Yeah.
I think this government closed down too early. and they are opening up too early, as opposed to Europe and the United States, which close too late and are opening too early. And we see that in the United States, where more than 15 states have now had to row back on the reopening. So I don't believe that we're going to have any reopening. I don't know the figures offhand. Again, my wife tells me the figures every night, and I say, I'm not terribly interested in them now, because, you know, that's like 2 weeks from now. Those are the figures. Those figures only come into play at that stage. We simply don't know. And this government is not above bullying us into doing what they want to do when they themselves are not sure of the situation. Ministers who should be talking are not talking. Ministers who, frankly, shouldn't be talking are saying too much. So we are in a state of confusion. And the fact is, I believe, as the president has said, we aren't anywhere near the peak, and that is going to happen. I'm very sorry to hear, as Canton says, but that's in the Western Cape. The figures are going up all the time.
And here,
I've got a situation where I don't know anybody who's caught it, but I have taken off my social media the numbers of people who are calling this a ploy, you know, blaming it on 5G and blaming it on Bill Gates and insisting that this is a ploy and that it doesn't exist. I've simply unfriended them, because it's such nonsense. But you can understand why it's happening. COVID has reached into Africa, all the African countries. Burundi, for example, which didn't have any cases because previous President Pierre Nkurunziza admitted, well, we haven't been testing.
Yeah.
Now suddenly they are, and the new president, Ndayishimiye, is saying that this is the biggest enemy, and he's taking steps all over the continent. In Mali, the worst security situation on the continent, COVID has now reached to literally the ends of the earth. In Timbuktu, they've got 9 deaths and 500 cases. So it's all over our continent. And as we grow, we see the taxi industry in South Africa saying, well, we're not going to obey government instructions to physically distance in the taxis. Well, let's see what the government does about that, because that is going to have a massive impact. Is it a case where, you know, there are enough policemen who own taxis that they're just not going to act, or that they're too afraid to fight against the taxi industry? We've got to be more muscular, but we're not being.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, we spoke a little bit about taxis last week, Canton, and it turns out that, you know, Fikile Mbalula really is on the back foot with these guys, and he has no authority with them.
Well, has Mbalula ever been on top of any situation?
No. Absolutely not. I think that's a fair comment. All right. So you guys sound like you may be, well, certainly, Jean-Jacques, you're saying let's not open in a hurry.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
No, I'm not saying that at all, Gareth. My view has been from the get-go that really what we should be doing is having a massive education campaign that is telling people the importance of social distancing, isolation of the most vulnerable members of our society, but by and large to let the economy actually continue to operate, simply because the consequences of people literally dying from starvation as a result of not being able to feed themselves, to my mind,
those deaths obviously much less glamorous, and we read much less about them. And when I say glamorous, I mean that in a truly sarcastic and ironic sense, because no death is ever glamorous, of course.
But absolutely, yes.
But it seems that if you die of COVID, you get recorded. If you die of starvation and hunger, oh well, that's just what was happening before and what will happen after anyway. So it's not the same. It doesn't get the same level of. If only the government had been as concerned about people dying of starvation before.
Can we, Canton, an education program, how much more can we possibly do? Do you believe that the people of South Africa don't know about physical distancing, the need to wash their hands, the need to protect the elderly? Do you think that there's a dearth of that?
Jean-Jacques, I think that to a large extent, what we are failing to take into account, it's not that people are uneducated, but they really have no choice in terms of how they go about trying to ensure that their families get fed, and that they are putting, you know, they're putting food on the table, they're keeping the lights on, they're keeping the heat on. And all of those things are absolutely crucial. So really what needs to be happening is a scenario where, for example, you know, my parents are in their 80s. And we have them absolutely on lockdown at their home in Durban. We do not allow them to go out at all. My brother does all of their shopping for them and that type of stuff. On rare occasions when they are allowed to go out, they have a car. They drive themselves down to the beach and they don't get out of the car. You know, they just gaze out at the waves and then come back home because they are both in that high risk group where if they actually pick up this bug, it's going to take them. For the rest of us, you know, I'm certainly being cautious in my dealings, but I'm probably not in as high risk a bracket as they would be.
Can we just talk about how untrustworthy these tests are? Because there are a lot of tests being rolled out, and we heard a horrible story just last week about those tests that were just found abandoned on the side of the road in Dantsane in the Eastern Cape. Not surprisingly, it was the Department of Health in that province, which is just a disaster. But these tests that people are undergoing in order to determine whether or not they have the antibodies, which may indicate that they have had or are currently going through COVID-19, they seem to be right half the time, and there are a lot of false positives that are coming out. Do you guys have any comments on that? Because I'm almost reticent. If I thought I had it, which I don't, but if I thought I had it, I don't know whether I'd be in a hurry to get myself tested.
Well, you saw the tests in Tanzania where they sent
pawpaws and goats and all kinds
exactly.
of
things. Exactly. I mean, so.
And that was not fake news, right? That was actually the Tanzanian prime minister.
Yes, it was indeed. Now, the fact is, they may be more reliable in South Africa. But, you know, what are we to say slow down the testing because that just gives us more cases, as Donald Trump has said, is insanity. So we should be testing more. There's no doubt. And that's what the World Health Organization is saying now, that their accent is on more and more testing. The testing for actual carrying COVID-19 and the testing for antibodies, those differ. And the point is, you know, it's like people saying, but because they pay VAT, they pay tax, even if they don't pay income tax. Yeah. We have to have proper testing, and that has to be improved. There's no doubt. But again, until we have vast numbers tested, we don't know how bad it is. 10 times. Who was it? We had a government minister just the other day say that the actual cases could be 10 times higher than what we're hearing. Without testing, we won't know.
Yes, but again, going back to important difference that you're pointing out there, Jean-Jacques, the difference between testing for infection and testing for antibodies. And Israel yesterday announced that it was rolling out mass testing for antibodies, in other words, to test for people who have potentially been infected, been asymptomatic, but are now effectively immune to further outbreaks of COVID-19. Mm-hmm. But out here, the scenario has been this complete fiasco in terms of the ability to get testing to the places where it really is necessary. And again, like the U.S. scenario, we had it being politicized. So because the Western Cape was as efficient as it was in terms of rolling out tests, we saw a dramatic increase in terms of the numbers out there. The Eastern Cape, by contrast, where, you know, probably about one-tenth of the quantum of testing that took place in the Western Cape on a per capita basis was happening in the Eastern Cape. And it turns out that, in fact, if you follow social media chains around people who live in the Eastern Cape, the uptick in terms of the number of deaths has been quite staggering. And really what we should be doing is getting AI bots to actually be crawling through social media to track down what's happening in terms of deaths of people, and using that, frankly, as a far more reliable means of gathering data.
You know, we're wishing away COVID-19 with the testing. You know, I think if my wife had one less pregnancy test, I'd have one less child, wouldn't I? Or if we had more IQ tests, we'd see just how many idiots we have in this country. You know, the fact is, we're not testing enough.
Your point is well received, certainly by Canton. All right.
Jean-Jacques has dropped some gems this morning, but the one-legged man at the ass-kicking competition takes the biscuit from me. Well done.
All right. So, guys, just quickly, I don't know if either of you had the inclination and wasted a few minutes of your life watching the president's Mbizo, which was an absolute disaster. I mean, just very poorly run, full of technical problems. God bless him for trying, but it was just an awful clusterfuck. And that's the kindest way I could describe it. How can we improve when it comes to the way that government communicates with us? I mean, we've got the GCIS, and it just seems like, first of all, even if the president had no technical problems last night, even if everything ran smoothly, his energy, again, I hate to quote Donald Trump here, but very low energy. The guy he seems like he's exhausted, he's out of ideas, he's trotting out the same old trope every time he gets asked any questions. There is no imagination in anything that he's said. It just seems like he's stuck and he doesn't know what else to say, so he's saying what he said before.
Thing is when he says, I'm going to do this, or this is what we're going to do, wait for it. Tomorrow, I'll have somebody explain more about it.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the briefing doesn't happen the next day. It's put off in some cases for 4 or 5 days.
Right.
The president stands there. He should say, this is what is going to happen and when. Give us a complete picture. And he hasn't been doing that. I agree that his energy looks like it's flagging.
It's like
very frightening for us.
Yes, correct. So do you have any comments on how GCIS operate and how they make the decisions that they do? Really, there are 1,000 places that the president would be welcomed where he could speak. He's never really accepted any of my invitations, but I don't blame him for that. What I think would be nice is if he could just once acquit himself admirably. We know he has skills when it comes to dealing with people. We know he's charming and people like him by and large, but he just seems to be making the most horrible appearances on TV and on radio. Horrible.
I think if anything, what we are seeing on the part of our president is that he lacks authenticity in terms of his messaging. And the reason why he's not able to speak with conviction, and the reason why he's not able to crank up the level of enthusiasm that would be necessary to inspire the rest of us, is because he's essentially putting out a message that has been drawn up by committee at Luthuli House, and his heart is clearly not in it. And it doesn't really matter how efficiently government communication information services end up running their technical infrastructure. If you don't have a message that's actually going to reach the hearts and minds of our fellow South Africans, what's the point? Really?
Very good point. Very good point, Canton. The thing is about government communication services the world over is that essentially, the people who get into the top jobs there are yes men to the president. So they are saying what the president wants them to say, and they're very fearful of saying anything that he doesn't. So they're yes men to the president. And when you have that, then democracy is weakened by it, and governance is weakened by it. So we need to have a more muscular communication service. But when I say we need to, then so does Bojo the Bog Roll Bandit, and so does Donald Trump, and so do all of them. You know, they've done a parlous job of communicating, and at this very, very difficult time, when they don't know, when their principal doesn't know what should be happening, they cannot possibly give us any kind of message. So when they have, I mean, you could start with Cyril Ramaphosa when he says he's going to brief at 8 o'clock to be there and do it. If you know that suddenly he's going to have to talk to a lot more people before he can come and talk to us, and the briefings are delayed by half an hour, an hour, then that makes you think, what is really happening? What's he going to tell us? Does he not know when he scheduled a briefing, does he not know what he's going to tell us by then?
Yeah, listen, from your mouth to God's ears. Quickly, something that came up on the TV show last night is Riedi Tlabi said that government may, with this you know, the lockdown levels, and they're considering going back in some places to level 4 and 5, which I think would be disastrous now because the genie's out of the bottle. But if they did, and let's say they did it for good reasons, let's say they were genuinely concerned for people, because we have huge numbers of road deaths and alcohol, and alcohol leads to domestic violence and all of that stuff. This is a very tough place for a libertarian to have their views pulled apart, because most of us go, well, people make their choices and we should respect those choices. And many people's choices lead to success and happiness, and other people's choices lead to misery and poverty and deprivation. But there's an argument to be made from a public health point of view that we aren't very responsible people in this country when it comes to alcohol and tobacco, for example. So, Canthan, I can more or less predict where you'd sit on this because we've spoken so many times. And I know that you feel that people should be allowed to make their choices, even if those choices are bad. Am I more or less correct with you? And then, Jean-Jacques, what is your point of view on this?
Well, are you moving towards prohibition, banning alcohol, because that is just not practicable? And the tobacco industry, I can understand their frustration, because what has happened is people are still smoking as much but buying on the black market. Yeah. If prohibition didn't work in the United States, I haven't read every reason for it being brought in, but I can understand that some of them were valid. The point is, we're not responsible. And, you know, am I to go back to what Canthan is saying? We need a better sort of education program on the use of alcohol. Perhaps that might help, but I don't see that banning alcohol is at all practicable. It will continue. The sale of alcohol, if it goes underground, will just feed organized crime. So it's something that we frustratingly have to live with. If you say that we're not responsible, should you take away our motor cars because we have a death rate on the roads that you know eclipses the death rate from the wars that we fought in? So we still are not driving any better. Of course, the two are linked, alcohol and driving. But how do you make some of that more responsible?
And more to Jean-Jacques' point, Gareth, consider that minibus taxis are responsible for 25% of all vehicle deaths in this country. Mm-hmm. Now, they don't represent 25% of the vehicles on the road. No. So should we eliminate minibus taxis? Because, you know, they have literally 25% of the road deaths are caused by minibus taxis. It's a slippery slope. Everyone who is now currently focusing on the fact that we have a problem in terms of a segment of our society consuming alcohol, they conveniently forget that we have a problem, a far greater problem, with other illicit drugs. I mean, like the curse of Niaupe, for example.
Yep.
People conveniently do not speak about it.
Yes.
And it is devastating, the impact of Niaupe in our townships. There is no effort whatsoever to actually control this. You know, I've made out a case in the past for us to adopt a Portugal type of scenario where we decriminalize the usage, but instead go after the people who are actually pushing the substances, so that we can actually focus our resources appropriately. We've gone exactly backwards here now. We are trying to prosecute people who are trying to feed their addiction, whereas the people who are actually making the bucks are smiling all the way to whatever illicit stash of cash they happen to have. Really, the entire idea that we can become a de facto Islamic state by banning alcohol is not going to fix the problem.
I'm afraid we're out of time. I could talk to you guys all day, and I think there are lots of people who'd like to hear more from you all day. But I'm afraid that's all we have the time for today. And Jean-Jacques, it's always great to have you on. So thank you for your time this morning on the Burning Platform. Canthan, always great.
Just want to say, apropos of government communications, by the way, I think that Trump's press secretary, Kayleigh McEnany, this is a flippant smart woman, really. She is so on point in terms of her engagement with the media. She's has facts at her fingertips. Just, you know, I'm really impressed.
And she's unflappable by the looks of things. I mean, she's
completely unflappable.
Does not tolerate.
I think Canton's too young to be so cynical.
Jean-Jacques, thank you so much. Canton, thank you. And we will catch you next week on The Burning Platform. It's brought to you by Nando's. You can always get the podcast. If you missed anything, go to cliffcentral.com. Thanks, everybody. See you tomorrow, 6 o'clock.
Cliffcentral.com.